Everyone, welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. It is the 23rd, a terrific Tuesday, and we've got a cram-packed show, so we're going to go ahead and get started. We have three great guests. We have Wayne Elliott, our favorite Canadian environmentalist. We have the creator of Grove, Jessica Patel, on financial literacy. And then we're going to talk about politics and principle with Dr. Kristen Monroe. Great show. Let's go ahead and get started. Here we go. Our first guest today is Wayne Elliott. He is an environmental entrepreneur out of Canada, has done incredible work with lithium recycling and with ship recycling. Wayne, welcome back to the show. How are you doing today?
Thanks, Jim. I'm just fine, thank you. How are you?
I am well. Wayne, tell us a little bit about lithium and lithium recycling. How did that need develop for you and your business? And then how did you get started with it? Just walk us through the lithium recycling, the birth of your thoughts on that.
Well, my first experience was many, many years ago, Jim, with a gentleman, genius, named Dr. Wilson Grayback from Clarence, New York, near Buffalo. Dr. Grayback invented the pacemaker, the heart pacemaker, and he invented the lithium battery to power it. He also had the very first lithium recycling process. It eventually burned down, as many lithium facilities do, and they usually burn down in the storage area of lithium batteries. He had a very basic, simple process that was less recycling, Jim. I don't think they recovered an ounce of anything, even the metal jacket in those days. I don't believe he recovered, but what he did do was deactivate the lithium. In other words, make those shred batteries, and they shred them one at a time, Jim. I stood and watched with Dr. Grayback, one at a time on a conveyor, an explosion-proof room, because every battery, lithium battery that you break, that you breach, there's an explosion and then a fire. And there's enough, the fuel for a fire, lithium fire, is water. So there's enough moisture in the atmosphere to feed a lithium fire. And what Dr. Grayback did, they shred these batteries one at a time, little explosion, and then they propelled the shredded components into a bath of potassium hydroxide, which would heat up, there'd be steam, but it deactivated it so that those contents were no longer reactive. Lithium is a reactive metal, and in my opinion, the most dangerous metal. Now, health people would tell you that the most dangerous metals to human health are, in this order, mercury, cadmium, and lead. Very serious consequences to our health. But to the environment, to the safety aspect, to these lithium batteries in cars, that was always distressing to me. We've heard about people's laptops catching fire, telephones catching fire, and certainly automobiles. So I believe it's unfortunate that we didn't find a better way than lithium. And now you hear about green hydrogen, and I don't know much about that, but that's another alternative. What we did, because we collected consumer batteries in over 5,000 sites in Ontario and got batteries shipped to us from elsewhere in Canada, many from the United States, it wasn't the main, what there is most of consumer batteries is the non-rechargeable alkaline batteries that most of us, unless you're using rechargeable batteries in your home and charging them, alkaline batteries are 85% approximately of all consumer batteries. All the other types are approximately 15%. Alkalines are 85%. So that's where we focused. Our biggest attention, and we created the best demonstrated technology in the world for recycling alkaline batteries. One of the products, the main product, we call black mass, that's consumed in the United States to grow corn for ethanol. And using 30 pounds of our black mass per acre mixed with the fertilizer products that they're being used created 20 extra bushels of corn per acre. So I was very proud of that, taking waste and turning it into a product like that. Of course, we recovered the steel from the metal jacket, and we had the highest recycling rate in the world at 84%. And the reason it was that low, we weren't allowed to landfill anything in Ontario from the batteries, and we weren't allowed to count the liquid or the paper and plastic that are in every alkaline battery. So at one point, the percentage was figured at over 90, but the no-argue, proven, tried-and-true figure is 84.5%, I think, percent. By far the best in the world, double any other effort, like throwing them in a furnace to only get the zinc. Zinc is the only thing of value in an alkaline battery. It's 20% or less of the total alkaline battery, and that's what most efforts, including in Europe, are, is throwing them in a furnace. Well, the trouble with it is, not only is it all that carbon from a steel mill furnace, but 80% plus, because there could be 20% content in something, call it zinc and alkaline batteries. There's no furnace in the world that will get you out the whole 20%. Some of that, 2-3%, will be in the slag, the non-value stuff that comes out of an industrial furnace. So what that means, Jim, is that 80% plus in those methods of so-called recycling, 80% plus is generated into waste. So hence our having the best demonstrated technology in the world. But lithium, I wish there was another way other than with lithium to do what we're doing, because I mean, it's a very dangerous metal. Obviously, when the last thing you want to do on a lithium fire is put water on it, that's like putting gasoline on another fire.
Right. I just learned that from you. I had never heard that before, and I will try to remember the next time I am in the middle of a lithium fire not to put any water on it. So
no, we used a very expensive, looks like very, very fine black baby powder, only very fine. It's called Lithex. And if you have a small fire, as we did once in a cement floor with a speck of pure lithium metal, it took about $20,000 worth of this Lithex to put it out. And by the time it put it out, that speck, like the size of the lead inside a lead pencil, that's how big the lithium metal speck was. It burned a hole through 13 inches of concrete to the earth, to the ground. So incredibly hot fires. And just recently, Mr. Elon Musk and the Tesla company, he had invested a great deal of money in coming up with a recycling process. Because, of course, building his electric cars, he's a huge consumer of lithium batteries. Small cells like you might use in your camera, but hooked together in series to a much bigger battery pack to be able to power that automobile. Well, he gave up on it about a month ago and laid off 15,000 people one Sunday. So it's very difficult. There are processes to actually, they claim to anyway, a process made in Germany to actually recover the lithium for reuse. Now that's if it works, that's a wonderful process, because reuse means you don't have to mine more lithium, or you have to mine less lithium. So the three R's are very important. You don't hear that too much anymore. Reduce waste, reuse waste, and recycle. So that's the three R's. I always loved it when someone buys a ship's part, or just recently a fellow bought a wheelhouse, an owner's accommodation from a ship, and took it away by barge to make a cottage. I love reuse of things that are still have use. So reduction of waste, of course, is the best. What you don't waste, you don't have to deal with. But that's pretty difficult. One way that we certainly could, Jim, is in the packaging, the incredible amount of packaging, the flyers we get in our mailboxes, just tremendous amount of what it becomes waste. And so there are ways to reduce it, certainly. We aren't really doing that in the world. I mean, I just about slit my wrist every time I try and open packages of things now. They're so difficult to open. Some of these hard plastic packages, you need to cut with scissors or a knife. And so we certainly haven't reduced. Back in the day when my grandparents started the grocery business 100 years ago, there was none of that packaging, Jim. If you bought three wieners, they were wrapped in craft paper and put in a paper bag. And I remember my grandpa, when he totaled your bill, it was with a pencil on the outside of the brown paper bag that your groceries were going in. And he'd add it up, and that's what you'd pay. So we haven't done a great job, certainly, at reducing waste. Look at the plastic bottles, Jim. It's at a crisis point in this world, and we're still making them. The plastic water bottles and other bottles. It really is. There's a flotilla in the Pacific Ocean, bigger than Rhode Island from that tsunami. And look at the birds and fish that are dying eating these microplastics. There's some very good documentaries on this, if anyone cared to watch them. Scary that when these birds and fish are just trying to eat what they like, other fish, bugs, whatever it is they eat, well, they're taking in these tiny pieces of plastic, and we're even killing the fish and bird population off. So, you know, and yet you can still buy many things in plastic bottles. We used to use glass. Glass is well recyclable. It doesn't contaminate anything. It's not made from chemicals. Plastic is made from chemicals. So, and man-made chemicals just may be the biggest evil to our planet and our health. Man-made chemicals. The Creator didn't make any of those chemicals. We only had natural metals and chemicals. We didn't have these man-made chemicals that surround our life. Our food is coated in them. Insecticides, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, chemical fertilizers, chemical preservatives. So when we eat produce, we're eating a lot of chemicals these days, and there's nothing we can do about it unless you have your own garden and can grow some nice food without putting chemicals on them. There's no way for the rest of us to avoid them. You go to the store and that's what they have. And 93% of all items on the store shelf are or contain genetically modified organisms. Some people call Frankenfood. All the seedless produce is genetically modified. It takes a seed to reproduce anything, a human, a giraffe, a pine tree. Everything takes a seed. Well, these have no seeds, so they can't reproduce themselves. And their immune system of the plant itself is very weak. We eat those weak plants, and what does it do to our immune system? So there are many of these issues that, you know, I think about every day. And every time I'm in the store, and they do bother me, and there isn't a darn thing I can do about it except try and eat healthily, and I just think we've made some huge mistakes.
I would agree. Wayne, let's wrap it up there. I appreciate you being with us today. Great information, as always. I love your stories and what you've done. How do you want people to find out more about you? What's the best website?
Well, our family company shipbreaking website and name is Marine Recycling Corporation. So they could go on that website to see if they're interested in ships and and some of the projects we've done. The battery company, which the assets have now been sold to another company, but that company's name was Raw Materials Corporation that I started 40 years ago. And it's now operated by E360, the company's name is. And that's it, I guess, Jim. I don't, I'm very technically incompetent. So I think there is a website on me, and I can't even tell you the name, and I don't know how to get to it.
We'll find that out and get it posted.
Yeah. All right.
All right, Wayne, have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jim.
All right. Bye-bye. We'll be back in just a second with another great guest. Bye-bye-bye. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to introduce another great guest to talk about a topic that really hits home for me as a daddy of four. Please welcome Jessica Patel. She is head of learning resources for the Singleton Foundation for Financial Literacy and Entrepreneurship. They have created a new tool called Grove, which is available now, and we will learn about it. Jessica has had an award-winning career in the editorial space as a journalist and also as a business leader. She and her content have appeared in Bankrate, The New York Times, The New Yorker, Gap, Her Money, and a bunch of other places. Jessica Patel, welcome. How are you doing today?
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me. I'm doing well.
Tell us about the Singleton Foundation.
Sure. The Singleton Foundation is all about bringing financial literacy and entrepreneurship to people in a different way, in a way that's really fun and really engaging and different than what most people see that's out there and available to them.
Why are our youth so financially ignorant? Is it the school's fault, the parents? Is it my fault, Jessica? Are we going to blame me?
I think we should blame you, Jim.
My wife. Welcome to my marriage, Jessica.
No, in all honesty, it's just because of the fact that there's been so much shifting and changing, right? We've gone from a primarily cash society to a cashless society, and it's really hard to manage that. And as with social media and all of the different things that are out there nowadays, it's really hard to find the time in there to find this kind of training, and we haven't made it as much of a priority as other things. And so the Singletons have kind of taken this initiative to build out things like Groove, where people can really learn about financial literacy in a new and different way, and to understand that money is personal and money is also emotional. It's not just about knowing what a mortgage is, but it's knowing how to get a mortgage. It's knowing if you get into debt, how it makes you feel and how that can affect your other areas of life and navigating through that.
I've seen some TikToks and some videos with young people crying, complaining about the system and people being shocked. They took taxes out of my check. What? And at 5 o'clock, I have a 2-hour commute and I'm exhausted and all I can do is go to sleep. How did my parents do it? Is that just one off? Is that the media being the media, or is it really a problem with our youth?
I think for our youth, it's just a different lifestyle, right? And with social media, it's basically doom scrolling. We are going to get more clicks off of something that tells you that things are terrible versus things that tell you that things are great, right? And so part of it, unless it's the extreme part of great, but there's a lot of people living in that middle ground. And if you train them properly and you train them to be financially solvent and train them to be financially successful while living within their means, you're going to have a more successful area. But what happens a lot of times is they just see all the bad and they forget to look at the good.
All right. What are the financial burdens that the youngsters are facing these days? Is it the same things we faced 30 years ago, or are the challenges different?
You know, I think the challenges, sometimes they're similar, sometimes they're different. I think that nowadays we are more emotionally aware. And so as a result of that, you kind of get into a different mindset, right? Where I'm too stressed. And so what we look to do is we look to kind of alleviate that stress but you're still having the same kinds of things of, I need to find a job, I need to buy a car, I want to buy a house, I have too much credit card debt. They're the same problems that persist. It's just the way that we handle them is different.
All right. Tell us about the is it a product, the new tool? Are you calling it an app, or what are you calling it?
Yeah, so we call it a platform or an app, and okay. Basically you can sign on either on your phone or on your computer, and it really is a way for people to identify their money personalities, and then more so to create positive financial habits and attainable goals for themselves, and to guide them and teach them for the things that they might not know in a nice, safe, and open and welcoming space that encourages them to keep learning.
Ooh, yeah, the money personalities. I want to ask about that. This is fascinating. There's about 8 of them. Walk us through this. This is absolutely fascinating. And how do you know which one you are?
So we have worked with behavioral scientists to come up with a scientifically validated test where you can identify which, when you take the test, which one of the money personalities you are. And once you identify that, each one has pros and cons. Like, for me, I'm a dreamer, and dreamers love to spend money because they always figure that things will work out and there will be more money available. But I'm very different than somebody who's a present-focused saver and really wants to save now and sometimes can have a hard time spending. And so once you identify that, we then give you the tools to navigate who you are and identify, oh, you know what? I'm definitely going to do this kind of thing. How do I work around this? How do I make my financial situation stronger, not in spite of myself, but because of myself?
All right. So the thoughtful manager, give me a sentence on that.
The thoughtful money manager, they are all about planning and knowing what they have. So they sometimes will be able to spend more on a vacation, but it's only because they have planned, I am spending this much on my vacation. I have planned this out so I can spend all of this money here. So they are very, very meticulous, almost like kind of a type A personality of planning out what they're doing with their money.
Cautious enthusiast.
Cautious enthusiast. They enjoy spending money, but they get very, very nervous about it. So they often will be like, oh, I don't know if I should do this. They also are really risk averse, so they're less likely to be investing for their future because of the fact that there's a risk of losing money, and that makes them nervous.
All right. You're the third category. You said dreamer?
Yes.
Explain that.
And so dreamers love to spend money. They also are planning for the future. They can be somewhat entrepreneurial, but they're one of those people who are like, there'll always be more money. It's totally fine. It'll all work out, which, you know, you have to be mindful of that, because if you're not budgeting and you're not planning for the future, it will be to your detriment.
All right. Present-focused saver.
Present-focused saver. These individuals think about the now a lot. They think about saving now. They also don't always think about their future, but they save for things that are happening now or in the nearish term, but they don't often think about long-term.
That seems like an oxymoron, because they're saving, which is a long-term activity, isn't it?
It is, but they're also saving for now. They're not saving for 30 years from now.
Vacation?
They're saving for, exactly, next vacation, the next big thing that's coming. You know, they're not thinking for a long-term kind of mindset.
Thrifty strategist.
Thrifty strategists are very thoughtful about their money. They are always looking for a bargain. They're always looking for a deal. They're trying to navigate spending the least amount of money.
I'm thinking about the pros and cons of each one of these, and I'm trying to figure, I still don't know which one I am. Careful optimist.
The carefree optimist is somebody who is even more free spending than the dreamer is, because they're like, everything's fine. And they will just continually spend even more so, where a dreamer thinks big because they're like, I'm going to do this big thing and this is going to be the next big thing that'll happen. And so everything will work out. But a carefree optimist will just spend freely and just want to do what they feel like, because they're like, it'll be fine. So it's a different kind. It's similar to the dreamer, but different in the sense that they're even more free with their finances.
That seems stupid. That's not a good one. Bold adventurer.
The bold adventurer are the risk takers, the people who are more likely to be entrepreneurs, to take those chances, to invest in riskier things for a riskier payoff, or to have fun because they know that, you know, they know they are more adventurous than a lot of others out there.
And finally, frugal entrepreneur.
So the frugal entrepreneur is very, they're very thrifty, but then they also have a little bit of that risk ability. So they'll be thrifty in their general parts of their lives, but then they might also be thinking about the future sometimes and being a little bit more leaning toward risk in the things that they want to do.
All right. I have to think that there's some good ones to these and some bad ones. The thoughtful manager seems like a good one to me. Do people have a primary and a secondary, Jessica, or are they just straight up one of these?
They're primarily just one of them. And really, there's no good or bad, right? Like, it's
your personality is...
Well, they aren't because some people have a really hard time spending money and some people have an easy time spending money. And it's just being able to navigate that, right? And saying, hey, you can be a carefree optimist, but you just need to set up a budget and be more mindful about what you're doing before it gets bad, right?
Oh,
and
good,
just like a thoughtful money manager sounds like it's a great thing, but maybe as a thoughtful money manager, you don't spend money on the things that you need. Right? Because you feel so closed in and you're so afraid to spend it, which is another problem, right? If you're too afraid to spend it, even though your toilet's been running for 6 months, but you don't want to spend the money to buy a new flush valve, how are you going to navigate that, right? They all have pros and cons, just like the humans in general do, right? And it's just, it's not saying one is bad and one is good. It's, they're both have their good and bad qualities, and it's navigating through that.
Ah, the dreaded broken flush valve. I hate when that happens. I can tell what you don't know about, Jessica. That's a good thing. That means you're outsourcing your plumbing. What about the person who collects Diet Coke points religiously? That level of cuckoo-ness, does that fall on here somewhere?
I think that goes into the thrifty strategist would probably be where it goes, right? The idea that you want to be saving and that you're trying to be thrifty and use those points for something else. So it's almost like that idea of you're getting a bonus and a reward for that.
Interesting. All right. How should people who don't know these things move forward? What are the goals they should set for themselves, and how does the app play in?
Sure. So each goal that you want to set is personalized based on what you want to do with your money. And so once you go to the app at groovemoney.org and you sign up and you understand your money personality, we set you up to try to create a money habit so that you're being more mindful about your money. And then after that, we try to set you up with a goal of something you want to do, whether it be small, whether it be savings related or investing or even paying down debt or getting a new job. So it's all different kinds of things. And then we guide them through that with small little step-by-step pieces of learning and content.
Fantastic. Jessica, how do we find out more? Follow online, get signed up, all of that.
Yeah, you can follow us and sign up at groovemoney.org, or you can go to the Singleton Foundation.
Fantastic. Jessica, thank you so very much, and I hope you have a great rest of the summer.
Thanks, Jim. Have a great one.
And we will be right back. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to introduce another great guest. Please welcome Dr. Kristen Monroe. She is a Pulitzer Prize nominee, written 20 books, is a professor at UC Irvine, and has had an incredibly distinguished career. She's actually a distinguished professor and the founder of the Ethics Center. She has just released a new book that is very political, and we acknowledge that, but we're going to have guests on both sides. Her book is called Politics, Principle, and Standing Up to Donald Trump, Moral Courage in the Republican Party. Dr. Monroe, welcome. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me on your program.
All right. So you are of the left. We are open about that so we can have an honest conversation. I appreciate that. Why are you writing about the Republican Party?
Well, I think it's a very interesting and very important topic. Should just say one statement. We all have our political views, and obviously everybody has their own perceptions. But I think when you write as a scholar, you try to put those behind you. And so one of the things that I was trying to do here in this particular project, which I did with some interns at the Ethics Center, I should add that right away, we wanted to try to understand the moral courage in the Republican Party, because there were a lot of people that you may or may not agree with their politics, but you have to admire them for having the courage of their convictions to stand up and take a lot of hits politically and have a lot of actually death threats and a lot of consequences that were negative for their careers because they did something that they thought was important for their conscience. So regardless of how you feel about Liz Cheney or Mitt Romney or any of these other people we analyzed in the book, I think you have to, regardless of your political affiliation, acknowledge that these are people who are trying to act on principle as they see it.
And the other side, Donald Trump is not? Is Donald Trump principle-less?
I'm not saying that at all. I'm just looking at these particular people. And I think there are some objective standards that you can look at, so that one of the things you try to do, if you're a scholar, or a scientist of some kind, you try to look at evidence. And so one of the questions that you would have to ask is whether or not people like Cheney, Romney, or Trump, or Biden, whoever the politician are, how much of the facts are they giving? Are they just giving opinions, or are they actually making things up? And I think that's a question that I think people have to assess very carefully, because we have a lot of different opinions that are floating around, especially in the media, as you know. There are people that see things from very different perspectives. So what are the facts that they, evidence that they come up with to support their arguments or their conclusions?
All right. What do you think that Trump is the most dishonest about or the least principled about? Foreign or domestic?
I don't, that's a hard question to say. I don't think Trump has a great deal of regard for the kind of scientific analysis that you would do. I don't think he's concerned a great deal about facts to support his opinions. Some of the things that he said last night during the debate, for example, were just patently untrue. And everybody makes overstatements and says things that aren't always factually accurate. I'm not saying that, but I think there's a degree. So, for example, when the argument about abortion, when he was saying that the Democrats have, and mentions the governor in Virginia in particular, that they advocate having abortion after a baby is born, I've never heard anything like that. I don't see any factual foundation for that whatsoever. And I think some of the fact-checking that some of the news people did pointed that out. So I think that that's one of the things that he's very strongly misstated. I think he's misstated his role in the January 6th insurrection. The statement that he offered Nancy Pelosi troops in advance, that he was concerned about violence and that she turned it down. I don't think there's any factual basis in that either. So probably domestic rather than foreign, but it's hard to say. I don't think he's someone who has a great deal of concern for the facts. I think Biden, on the other hand, kind of got lost in the nuance of facts. He was trying to give facts and he wasn't able to give clear answers. So neither one of them did very well in the debate, I don't think.
Do you think Biden should step aside?
Personally, or as a scholar, I don't know. I think that there's a lot of dissatisfaction with Biden. I think probably realistically Gavin Newsom is right. It's too late for this, and I think he had a bad night. We have to hope he does better if you're supporting him. I think he's probably a little old for this. And I don't know if he had a cold or just a bad night. We often have people who Obama did very poorly in the first debate the second time around, and he bounced back on the last two. But Biden did not do well in this. His age showed. He seemed to be rambling. He didn't seem to be focusing on the actual question, although neither did Trump. Trump didn't even try to answer the question. So the question on climate control, for example, he went back, climate change, he went back and said, I have to correct what Biden said. So he didn't even try to answer the questions. So I don't think either one of them had a very great great performance last night.
I was very disappointed in the entire thing.
Most people were. Yeah, we were out. My husband and I were out at a restaurant before the debate, and I wanted to be sure to get back in time to watch it. And so we were kind of leaving, and as I was standing there, there was a big TV screen with some wrestlers that were throwing their bodies at each other. And I, as a joke, I said to my husband, hurry up, the debate's already started. Then when they got into the discussion of golf, it was like, oh my God, these people are like 11-year-old kids trying to see who can do a better golf swing. I think most people thought that was sort of the low point of the debate. And I do think the moderators should have cut them off at different points. I don't think the moderators did a great job either. What did you think about that?
I thought that the microphones being cut off really helped Trump because it helped him. He didn't have the opportunity to say stupid stuff and to interrupt and to be the jerk that he is. And so I think that the microphone being turned off was a huge disadvantage for Biden because Trump's bad characteristics were cut off. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I think that's interesting. I thought the moderator should have engaged more in a debate that said, you have 48 seconds left. Do you want to answer the question? They weren't answering the question, especially Trump. But they needed to be a little more focused and hold them more to the point. It deteriorated very quickly into name calling. You're the worst president. I'm the worst president. It's like, where's James Buchanan? He's getting left out of this entirely. It was just kind of it was a little bit like boys having a pissing contest, So it was disappointing. I saw some of the commentary afterwards, and they had some voters in Arizona, I believe, who were not committed one way or the other. They were trying to decide, and the moderator asked them, how would you describe the debate? And one person said, cringe, with the terms that you really... It wasn't the Lincoln-Douglas debates, but I don't know if elections are actually settled on the basis of debates either. So, but I think one of the interesting questions that we tried to get into in the book was, what is Trump all about? Is he an anomaly? Is he politics as usual? He doesn't seem to be politics as usual. And if you look at the policy questions, and that's, again, I think a misunderstanding that people have. They think people vote on the basis of policy, and they really don't. There's a lot of evidence now that you like somebody, you like the way he looks, he seems like an attractive person, and so then you find reasons to align up with your policy. It doesn't mean policy doesn't count, but Trump is not someone who has disagreed on a lot of policies with the people that we analyze. So if you look at Cheney or Jeff Flake or Romney, these are all very conservative Republicans who basically like a lot of the policies that Trump has advocated. I think their concern with him focuses on really the idea that he's not a real conservative, that he's more about political expediency and political loyalty than about particular policies, that he is not someone who understands or is terribly respectful of democratic norms. And I think the evidence that they use there, which was discussed at the January 6th committee, is rather convincing, trying to call up people like Raffensperger and getting them to find extra votes. And then I think there's a kind of visceral reaction that's a kind of very basic identity questions. This is not who we are. We're not Republicans. I gave a talk on the book at a place in California, and a woman came up afterwards and said, I'm a lifelong Republican, and he lost me at grabbing by the pussy. And I think there are a lot of Republicans. Miles Taylor, who was one of the people we interviewed and we analyzed in the book, said that he was very concerned about the policies of separating children from their parents at the border and then putting children in cages, and that Trump kept coming back and saying, we have to reinstate this, we have to reinstate this, because otherwise people won't know. If you're not harsh with them, they'll keep coming across the border. And Taylor said he just thought, this is not who we are. This is not what Republicans are like. Republicans are not people who do things like this. And it was a basic kind of human decency question. And I think that's one of the things that has most of these people concerned, that they see the election as a kind of plebiscite on whether or not we're going to continue to follow democratic norms and respect the oath of office. They all talked about taking an oath of office and that meant something to them. So that even at the hearings, you could see people like, what's his name from Arizona, Rusty Bowers from Arizona said, this is not who I am. You know, you want me to do something? It's illegal. It's against my oath of office. And Bowers is a strong supporter of Trump. So I think this is one of the things that people on either side can feel. I think there's a lot of people on the Democratic side who find some of this political correctness. It's just gone crazy. It's gone too far. And this is the sense that this is not who we are as a people. This is not what Americans do. This is not how we behave. So I think that's a very gut kind of reaction that people, the people we analyzed had to Trump.
How do we stop lying in the political process? And I believe, you probably won't believe this, but I believe that they're equally bad. You know, I can find as many Democrat lies as I think you could find Republican lies. How do we stop it? How do we, you know, actually hold people accountable and say, you know, you got caught and there's actually a consequence to this, especially from an ethical standpoint, you know, considering you're the ethics professor.
Well, I think from an ethics point of view, you have to be honest about things. You have to admit that your side, you can't just be partisan. You have to admit that your side does things that are wrong too. So I grew up in a small town in Illinois. My grandfather was in politics. My father was a judge, and I believed in fairness. And I have a lot of friends who are from that area who were very strong Trump supporters. And I tried to ask them, why do you like about Trump? And when we would talk about things, I had to admit to them and say, honestly, as a Democrat, when Bill Clinton did what he did and was impeached, the best thing possible for people who felt as I did politically would have been to have him be impeached, because he committed it. He lied under oath. That's not something you should do. And it was a political thing that was made. And I said, you should feel the same way about Trump. If you really like the policies, you have Pence there who's going to be exact. You know, there's no bimbo problem. There's no, potty mouth. He knows how to operate things. Getting rid of Trump would be the best thing for your cause. And you have to admit for your side as well that you can't just be political. So I think you have to have people that will stand up and say, fair is fair. And if the other side does something that I admire them. Admit it. I had tremendous respect for some of these people after I read more of their works. Liz Cheney, for example, was not somebody I knew that much about. I hadn't spent, time studying her. She was amazing in some of the things that she did. She would have demonstrators who came. She would invite them in. She would talk with them. When she was in Congress, she would go to the other side of the aisle and find somebody who voted differently than she did. And she'd say, explain to me why you voted this way. She genuinely wanted to understand. And I think one of the things that we found about moral courage is that people who have moral courage, they believe in fairness. They believe in equality before the law. Even when it's going to hurt them, they go ahead and they operate that way. And so I have tremendous respect for some of these people after I studied them before, and I hadn't before. So I think you have to go into things with an open mind, with the idea that there are some objective standards that you adhere to. And even if somebody you care about and love very deeply violates those, you have to say, you violated it. You have to go to jail, or you have to pay the penalty, whatever the consequences are. And the consequences can be at the ballot box. They can be through the legal system. But you have to have a sense that there's an independent standard of fairness, justice, equality that is there for everybody, not just for the people that you like. And I see too little of that in politics. I wish we had more of it.
I see none of that in politics. I mean, I think they're all lying. You know, all the stereotypical joke. How do you know a politician is lying? Their lips are moving. You know, it's just so true. You know.
I think I would disagree with you on that. I think that there are degrees. I'm not saying everybody's perfect, but I think there are degrees. For example, I think Lynn Cheney, she took a lot. She didn't have to do what she did. And yet I think she felt that this was not something that Republicans did. And this is a woman who's, you know, she's Republican royalty. Her whole life she's been a devout conservative, very ardent conservative, has all the credentials. And yet she thought that there was something that was a violation. She stood up and she said that. And so she took a lot of hits politically. She's had death threats. Her dad told her, are you sure you want to do this? And she said, no, her integrity was more important as a person. And I think that's, you have to think about what it is that really matters in the end. And that's where I think you get into ethical questions. It's not just about politics. It's what was it like at the end of the day for you? Can you look yourself in the mirror? You know, my dad used to always say, you have to make decisions that are unpopular. It's because you can't look at yourself in the mirror when you shave in the morning. Well, most women don't shave in the morning, but you have to be able to look at yourself in the mirror. And a lot of these people talked about their kids. How, what am I going to tell my children afterwards? And because they felt that this was a very important election, that democracy, there are things on the line other than just, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, that there are actually deeper issues that are going on. They did liken it. A lot of people talk about Nazi Germany. I've studied that period extensively, so I know a lot about it. And democracies don't usually die from someone conquering them. They usually die from within. They're kind of peaceful things. And I do think that there are some threats to democracy now that are going on. And I think that's what these people thought. And so that's a question for the American public to ask. Do you think that this election is really going to threaten democracy? And as you say, I think there are people that feel it comes on both sides. So you have to look at the facts objectively for yourself. Make a decision.
Let's switch topics a little bit. You've written extensively about altruism. It's been in the news, not 100% recently, but in the last year or so, with the Sam Bankman-Fried, got a lot of abuse during that time. Tell us about altruism.
Well, altruism is interesting. It's behavior that's designed to benefit someone else, even if it hurts you. And it's important because it's rare, but it continues to exist. And they've done all kinds of interesting studies on it, that groups that have a certain number of altruists actually tend to do better than other groups. It was interesting for me because I was trained as a rational choice theorist, which is says that people, if you want to understand how human beings operate, you assume that they will do what they think is in their best interest, subject to information and opportunity costs. And altruism doesn't fit that. It doesn't fit into that model. And so that's one of the things that it was interesting to study. Again, that put me in touch with identity, that at the end of the day, it's who you are as a human being. Are you happy with yourself? Can you live with yourself? Do you feel you did the right thing? And one of the people we interviewed was a woman who had been a Dutch teenager during the war. She was actually in college in social work. And she came out of the school one day and she saw the Nazis throwing in Jewish orphans into a truck to take them away. And some of the Dutch women tried to prevent them, and they were thrown in also. And she said she was in shock, and she stood there and didn't do anything. She couldn't move. It was like, what's happening here? And she said, we all have memories of times when we should have done something and we didn't, and it gets in the way during the rest of your life. And I think that's why one of the reasons altruism is important, and one of the reasons ethics is important is general, is because who you are as a human being is basically all you have at the end of the day. You come into this world with nothing and you go out of the world with nothing. Who you are as a human is all you really take with you. And so I think that's why ethics is important, and altruism is especially important. If we have all kinds of political ideals and things, economic things we want, and yet you also have to think about your humanity, and how you treat other people has a great deal says who you are as a human being. And so that's something I think you have at the end of the day.
Very interesting. Are ethics dead in the United States?
Oh, no, not at all. There are all kinds of wonderful people doing all kinds of things. You can see in, you know, look around you at the local level. You can see it. People do a lot of volunteer work. You can see it in professional life. I mean, just look at yourself. There are probably many reasons why you do what you do, but some of them have to do with feeling that you're contributing to society. You're doing something which is good. You could make a lot more money doing other things. You could probably be more famous doing other things. And yet, why is it that you want to do something that makes the world better? Because that's what it means to be a human being. It's not something that, in some ways, altruism isn't really something you do for other people. It's because you want to feel that you're, well, you do it for other people, but you also do it because that's what it means to be a human being, and not somebody that's just after more money or more fame or more whatever it is that you want in life. I think ethics is very important, and I think you see it in every day, even in little kids. They've done a lot of surveys and studies with young children, and children will share toys. They will cooperate. They will do things with other people. They're not always, you know, it's not all good or not bad, but there is altruism does exist in people. It's very clearly there. It's not something you can write off or smuggle into saying it's just a delayed form of self-interest, which is what a lot of people like Nobel laureate Gary Becker have said, Richard Dawson. It's not just because you feel good about yourself. It's you genuinely want people to be better. I did an interview with a woman who was, she'd been a model. She was Catholic. She married somebody who was Jewish. In those days, they disowned them because of the religious differences. And she had a lot, ended up, her husband became very wealthy. She gave away a lot of money to children who had disabled, either they'd been abused or they had some kind of physical disability. And she told the story about going to take school treats to her son for his class for Christmas. And she said, I made a right turn, which was a wrong turn, which was really a right turn. And she ended up in the classroom with these kids who were, there was nobody there, there was no treats for them. She gave away her son's goodies for the Christmas party because she couldn't say no to these kids. And she said, it makes you feel, you realize that you've changed somebody's life. You can make them feel better. And that's what's important. And she said, I said, well, but economists will say you're doing it because you want to feel good about yourself. And she interrupted me and said, that's very cynical. What goes around comes around. Yes, but that's not why you do it. And I think the people that I interviewed, and especially the people who rescued Jews during the Holocaust, these were people who risked their lives, and they suffered a lot. Some of them ended up in concentration camps and cut cells. But it was, that's what it means to be a human being. You don't walk away from somebody else who's suffering. And so I think there are a lot of people for whom ethics is very important.
How do we find out more? Follow you online, Dr. Monroe. Get a copy of the book, all of that, please.
Well, there should be a website which is up. If you go up and type my name in, you'll find all kinds of information about me on the web. It's Kristen Renwick Monroe. I teach at University of California at Irvine. If you click in UCI Ethics Center, you'll see all kinds of work about the Ethics Center. We have a wonderful program every summer. We don't charge anybody any money for the program. We have about 500 kids from all over the world now who come and they get involved in mentoring. The book was done with 13 of these young people. They'd worked with me on a project. They wanted to keep on working and doing research. And it's just so exciting to see these young people who are hopeful, they're eager, they're enthusiastic. They just want to learn and they want to affect things in the world and they want to affect things for the better. So it's a wonderful program we have. It's just UCI Ethics Center. You'll find all kinds of information there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us. And I'll see you at the ballot box.
My pleasure. Thank you for raising the topic. It's an important one. I appreciate you doing it. Bye.
I do care. I'm a Republican and I want to have a strong party, and I don't necessarily believe in a lot of the policies out there, and I don't like a lot of the people, but I do want the party to move forward. You know, I believe in small government and limited and, you know, immigration and stuff like that. So anyway,
so do these people. That's why they did it. They felt that he's hurting the Republican Party, and I agree with it. So we're in heated agreement. Thank you very much.
We are out of time, but That's right. We come back tomorrow. Be safe, everyone. Take care. Bye now.